Periscope Youth Radio at MIT, New Hampshire Public Radio, and PRX.org, the Public Radio Exchange, this is Fresh Greens, a youth-produced radio special about teens and the environment. I'm Hisham Hajros.
And I'm Manon Bonet. What does it mean to be green? That's what we asked fellow teens from around the country. Their responses surprised us.
From Anchorage, Alaska, to Portland, Maine, teens see green as meaning a whole lot more than remembering to recycle.
Green, they told us, is not about the color of their skin or how much they donate to Greenpeace.
It's about listening to immigrants' experiences, to environmental leaders, and to that voice inside.
And it's about believing that one person can make a difference, and then spreading the word.
Coming up, Fresh Greens, a youth-produced radio special about teens and the environment. First, this news.
Periscope Youth Radio, New Hampshire Public Radio, and PRX.org, the Public Radio Exchange, this is Fresh Greens, a youth-produced radio special about teens and the environment. I'm Anon Bonet.
And I'm Hisham Hajros. Teens all across America are deciding for themselves what it means to be green. They're recycling and thinking about global warming, but they're not stopping there.
Teens today are thinking beyond dire predictions about the Earth.
They're thinking about race and who gets to call themselves green. They're considering what they can learn about conservation from immigrants' experiences.
They're redefining environmental impact to mean something positive, and they're thinking about what's in their food and where it comes from. I'm Manon Bonet. I'm 14, a vegetarian, and I try to bike or take public transportation as often as I can.
And I'm Hisham Hajros. I'm a 16-year-old Muslim American, and I ride my bike too. But unlike Manon here, I'm a meat lover. So how does that square with being green? This first piece by Alex Gervos from Terrascope Youth Radio offers one opinion. Check it out.
Green, 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 green. We've all heard it. How we must make changes for the goodness of our environment. However, all these people who are willing to say we need to go green, how far are they really ready to go? Do you believe you're truly an eco-supporter? Ask yourself, would you be willing to make the following changes to your life so you can save the environment?
Huh?
Now, if you're like me, you love a nice hot shower and just let it run over you for, like, ever. So for the greenies out there, are you willing to take colder showers and or shorter showers for the goodness of the environment? Now, I am a proud meat eater. I like my steaks, my burgers, and especially my bacon. However, the environment does not. So I want to stop eating meat to cut down on greenhouse gases? Vegetarian or veggie killer, you decide. Like, LOL dude, I'll BRB. Now, we all use a computer to chat, play games, or just have some fun. And sometimes we just leave our television running while typing up to all our friends and so on. So can you resist LOLing your friends? And can you focus on just one device to help cut down on energy being wasted? Can you live a few minutes without being surrounded by technology? Gasp!
Oh, no!
So if you said yes to all these questions, and you actually meant it, congratulations. You prove your eco-greenness and are willing to make changes that a lot of these fakers out here probably would not.
Here we go, yo! Here we go, yo! So what, so what, so what's the scenario? Here we go, yo! Here we go, yo! So what, so what, so what's the scenario?
That was Alex Gervos from Periscope Youth Radio at MIT. Well, Hisham, does the fact that you eat meat make you feel less green than me, a vegetarian?
Well, let's put it this way. I want to help the environment, but I need meat to survive. So if there's no meat, then I won't be around to help the environment. But I do think Alexander makes an interesting point about people who call themselves green, but can't quite commit.
I agree. That's why I appreciated this next story by Anthony Harigi from Youth Radio in Oakland, California, who traveled all the way to his parents' native Mexico to size up his own energy consumption back in Los Angeles.
This is the sound of convenience in my house. Microwave, television, computer, stereo. We use these appliances a lot. My 14-year-old brother Alexis is the main culprit. He leaves the lights on and appliances unattended. I, on the other hand, try not to waste that much energy. I caught him upstairs playing on the computer and a handheld video game called a DS at the same time.
I'm not on the computer and the DS at the same time, only computer and TV.
And then you play on the DS and then you're on the TV at the same time, or the computer and the TV at the same time. Or the computer and the DS at the same time, or the computer, the TV, and the DS at the same time.
No, that's crazy.
You do that.
You're the one who does it.
I use it more than you?
Of course. You sleep with the radio on and you don't turn it off until the morning.
That's not true.
You told me five times.
Okay, maybe we both use more energy than necessary. But my parents have tried to teach us to be mindful about energy. They grew up in a totally different era in a small town in Mexico.
I used to pick up the manure of the cow and also the manure of the donkeys.
Here's my dad talking about his first lesson in energy.
I was like 7 years old, and I used to sell it in a place where they use the manure to burn it. So that was the energy that, besides the wood, you know, but sometimes it's hard to get wood in a certain time of the year.
That's the gas delivery man in my dad's hometown, Jalostotitlan. He's saying, gas. He's shouting out the window of his truck to sell tanks of gas to the townspeople. This summer, I visited my family there, and I learned a lot about energy in a new way. The scenery in this town is quite different from my neighborhood in Los Angeles. I see sandy streets, red brick houses, and large open ranches. I also noticed something bizarre. On the rooftops of many houses, there are large metallic panels. I stopped by my neighbors to ask, what's it all about? The person who answers the door is an elderly lady named Guillermina González. She tells me the panels are her solar-powered water heating system. She says that over the past 25 years, she has conserved not only gas, but also tons of money. It seems that energy use is on people's minds here, more than L.A. This makes me wonder, am I an energy brat? When I'm home in L.A., I even complain about going outside to put my clothes in the washing machine. Here at my grandma's in Jalisco, I'm getting used to being in the washing machine.
And now I'm doing laundry. Here is all hand wash. I'll get the water from this water reserve. It's like the inside of a toilet. It's like a little pump, and when the water runs out, it refills. And I just grew.
When you go through trouble getting something, then you really appreciate, you know, then when you have it.
I've always had energy at my fingertips, so I haven't really thought about where it comes from or how much I use. My parents have had it harder, and maybe that's where they get their mentality about energy.
Like, I don't know if you remember where your mother used to live. On the top of the hill, she used to go down there to get the water. She had to walk a lot to get some water. So now when you guys or me even use a lot of water, she really got upset because she knew how hard it was to get the water. And now that we have the water, sometimes we waste it.
I always thought my mom was just tripping on me whenever I left the water running. But now I understand the chill that must run through her spine when she sees me waste water. Now that I'm back in L.A., I'm more dedicated to saving energy. Not only do I turn off the lights, but I even caught myself looking through articles on energy conservation and careers. I used to think energy was only an issue in my house, but now I realize that it's an issue affecting the whole world.
Mira lo que vi, dos modos como podría salir, esta vida solo para mí, o de mejor junto a ti. Mírame que este amor me dejó pata arriba, ay güerita, mi florecita, déjame te quiero sacar a bailar, a olvidar las penas de la semana, mamá, dame una quebrada manita.
That was Anthony Jarecki from Youth Radio in Oakland, California. You know, Manon, I recently returned from a trip to North Africa. Sometimes I wish that everyone could see how little energy people in other countries use. Not necessarily by choice, but by necessity. It really makes me think about what I quote-unquote need to use here.
Anthony and Alex's stories got all of us thinking about our own habits and energy consumption. We wondered, do other teens believe that one person can make a difference? And what would it take to get them to turn off their televisions and lights?
So our fellow interns at Terrascope Youth Radio took to the streets of Cambridge with microphones in hand and discovered that budding environmentalists and energy brats are everywhere. Here's what some of them had to say.
When it comes to hurting the environment, I think I kind of do a lot of things. So like my phone charger, I leave it in all the time. Most of my time my TV's on, I'm not home, but I try to turn it off sometimes, but I don't know.
If there are appliances that are not in use, I would turn them off. And definitely recycle things that are recyclable. And be smart with... Basically think about what my actions affect everything else.
I keep my phone on, charging like all night. And then I have this light. I'm not going to call it a night light, but it's like a light that stays on in my room. And like the light stays on in my house, like the kitchen light. I could turn that off. TV stays on, a whole lot of stuff.
One person can make a difference, but it depends on what they're trying to make a difference for. It's something like going green. No, there's not a chance. One person can make a difference.
Everybody
can make a difference.
Every
one person. It's like you're building a tree.
Well, one person can make a difference, because if one person starts to recycle and work together with just like trying to change other people, like help other people change, then you can create a whole group and then a community of people who want to be environmentalists.
Usually at nighttime I have 4 conditioners and 3 fans going. My mom's TV and my TV and the computer stays on. And my turtle filter and my snake light and my cable box. And my mom's cable box.
Would you ever think about turning those off if it was better for the environment? Or?
No.
Those opinions were gathered by interns at Terrascope Youth Radio at MIT. Coming up, teens in Alaska see rising sea levels eat away at their village and worry about the effects of climate change.
I also remember climbing onto the old seawall. It was just sandbags covered with like wired fence or something. They expected that to last a long time, and it didn't. Every year we would see more and more of the sandbags go under the water till eventually there was nothing. There's still like a little brick of them that you can see, which is kind of sad. It reminds us that that was supposed to keep us safe, and it's not there anymore.
And a young environmentalist in Austin, Texas, considers her impact and how environmental activists might better communicate their message.
We're on our way for a nice leisurely swim at the Barton Springs Spillway, when suddenly we ran into 2 Greenpeace representatives.
That's when we come back. You're listening to Fresh Greens from Terrascope Youth Radio, New Hampshire Public Radio, and PRX.org, the Public Radio Exchange. I'm Anon Bonet.
They paid paradise and put up a fucking lie. With a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? They paid paradise and put up a fucking lie.
Welcome back to Fresh Greens from Terrascope Youth Radio, New Hampshire Public Radio, and PRX.org, the Public Radio Exchange. I'm Anon Bonet.
And I'm Isham Hadros. You're listening to a youth-produced public radio special. This hour, we're hearing from young people all over the country about what it means to be a teen and green.
Amina James from Youth Radio in Oakland, California, wants green to be a color for everybody. Here's her thought-provoking essay.
I've been an environmentalist since before I can remember. It started with recycling. Then I started lecturing my friends and family about how we are all connected to the earth, from the trees that help us breathe to the animals we eat. But what gets me is whenever I tell my brother, don't throw your trash in the ground, or do you really need that bag of chips? He'll always say, why are you coming at me with that white people stuff? Don't tell him I said so, but my brother's got a point. When you see an environmentalist on TV, it's usually a bald white guy with a PhD at the end of his name lecturing about how we need to save the polar bears or stop the ice caps from melting. Don't get me wrong, I love some of these guys. Like my favorite, David Brower. He said, we're not inheriting the land from our fathers, but we're borrowing it from our children. My thing is getting my friends and family to hear that message from me, a hippie black girl still in high school. And so I look to Van Jones as a role model. He's pushed for training city youth to do things like install solar panels and plant urban gardens. Jones is middle-aged and has a fancy degree from Yale, but he's also black and engaging young people like me. He's famous for making the environmental movement more fashionable for more people. He calls it Green is the New Black. So my passion is making black the new green, too. I want to empower folks like my brother to realize the diversity of the green movement. So he puts his own orange peels in the compost bin, and I don't even have to remind him.
This land of rock and of mud, bound upon layers of blood, where once our forefathers stood, will one day return to wild woods.
That was Mina James from Youth Radio in Oakland, California.
Now, to Austin, Texas, where Zoe Martin from Youth Spin wonders how environmental activists can better convey their message and how she can have a positive environmental impact.
It was a sizzling spring day, and my good friend Andrew and I were on our way for a nice leisurely swim at the Barton Springs Spillway, when suddenly we ran into two Greenpeace representatives. By the time we saw them coming, it was too late. We'd been spotted, and the time to pretend that I'd forgotten something back at the picnic tables had come and gone. They advanced, clipboards in hand. So hey, do you guys care about the environment? Yes. She began telling us about Greenpeace and how we should join and sign up for their monthly donation membership. Both Andrea and I are self-proclaimed activists who strive to be conscious and mindful of our impact on the world around us. However, we were also very conscious of how uncomfortable we were with this fellow environmental activist. We felt guilty and awkward for not wanting to set up a monthly donation pledge. This is Greenpeace. It's not like saying no to an Avon representative. If Andrea and I were becoming put off by her antics, I tried to imagine how less like-minded folks might respond. This situation made me feel torn. It made me feel stingy and selfish for wanting to avoid these Greenpeace representatives in the first place. By these street teamers starting out by asking questions like, "Do you care about the environment?" it makes me feel that not signing up and donating is a snub to nature. Where's the happy medium? I don't want to become a martyr who gives up all of her sweet potato empanada and concert money so that she can donate it all to charity. But I also don't want to take what privilege I have for granted, spending most of my personal resources on frivolous things. I might not have a lot of cash to throw around, but time is my disposable income. And it is a resource that I love to give freely whenever I can. My conversation with these street teamers forced me to look harder at how I'm expressing my concern and care for these pressing environmental issues. Instead of just trying to figure out what my destructive footprint is on the world, I prefer to look at it from somewhat of a more positive angle. How am I constructively impacting the world? What is my positive footprint? How am I working to leave an inspiring impression? And how am I encouraging others to do the same? I believe that in order to make this green movement truly sustainable and successful, we environmentalists need to make people feel inspired and motivated, instead of ashamed and alienated. I don't want people to agree with me or give me money because I make them feel guilty or just so I'll leave them alone. As an environmentalist, I'm going to have to talk to plenty of people who don't agree with me. However, this challenge motivates me to become better informed and aware so that I can share that knowledge with others in an urgent yet still empowering manner. This green movement has so much unifying power. Let's make it a revolution based on informed and compassionate action, not shame and guilt. These issues are concerns that affect us all, and I want to help others recognize just how much common ground we all possess.
Warm panda cola, buttermelon in the sun. I need some clean air in my lungs.
That was Zoe Martin, a producer from Mute Spin in Austin, Texas. And now, a young producer from Portland, Maine, wonders whether she's done enough to help the environment. Anna Flanagan from Blunt Youth Radio reports.
As far as my high school goes, I was the leader of the environmental movement. I was a co-president of Portland High School's Environmental Club. We met every Tuesday afternoon, and we did work really hard. We promoted recycling, collected bottles to return, had more efficient front doors installed, and over the years we've raised thousands of dollars for Heifer International. But now, 2 weeks after graduating, I'm talking to my co-president and the vice president of the club, and we're wondering if we did enough.
I'm afraid we didn't do it justice because there's hardly anyone who's planning on being in the club next year. Sometimes I'm afraid that we were kind of cliquish about it, or maybe just that when we were running it, we put our own personality too much onto the club, and people who don't have our personalities weren't interested. But it was probably the bottle collecting that drove them all away.
Did how we behave at club meetings and around school influence people's ideas about the importance of putting an end to global warming? Did we do enough to save the planet? And are we really as environmentally friendly as teens come?
What do you think about the idea that of the whole 900 or 1,000 or something students, us three, are supposed to be the most environmental?
That's pathetic. Well, for one thing, I hate that in all the assemblies no one ever mentions the environmental club, because honestly, by rights, every single person in the school ought to be in it. That's the only way anything's really going to get done. For another thing, if we're the most actively environmentally friendly people in the school, our Earth is doomed. Not that we're bad, we're just kind of a mess about it.
Yeah, I mean, like, at home, I'm good about, oh, I don't need that light, I'm gonna turn it off, or, oh, I need to run this down to the recycling before my dad throws away all of this stuff that could be, you know, used again. But, like, honestly, when it comes down to it, I'm not, like, huge environmentalist, you know? So if, like, I'm the most in our school, that's just so depressing. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just ridiculous.
Yeah, I don't do much more than the bare minimum.
Yeah.
Yeah, I recycle. The whole world should do that.
And again, it's not that we're not working hard for the environment. It's just that we don't see ourselves as radicals, and we know that our peers do, which means they must be doing even less than what we're doing. This is disheartening. I mean, with a student body and a country and a world doing less than what we're doing, how can we all actually make a change and really stop global warming?
So how do you think that the human population is going to stop it? Do you think it's going to be individuals?
It can't be individuals.
That's not possible.
Because individuals are not the biggest problem, I don't think. Well, in a way they are, but it's like, it's an entire cultural mindset that we have to change. Because then the individuals not just doing their individual thing, but also the individuals running corporations and the individuals in the government will have the same, you know, individual mindset.
How do we change the mindset that is so deep in how we act as a culture? Sadly, this is a question Portland High's Environmental Club hasn't found the answer to yet.
That was Anna Flanagan from Blunt Youth Radio in Portland, Maine. So far this hour, we've heard from a number of teens who are considering how to have a more positive impact on the environment. Now let's hear the flip side of that. Teens who worry about the impact environmental change is having on them. Here's a report from Nithya Thiru and Nikki Navio of the Alaska Teen Media Institute.
Shishmaref is a small village located 100 miles north of Nome in the Arctic Circle. Due to the adverse effects of climate change, the land the community sits on has been falling into the ocean.
Three teens from Shishmaref, Teresa Olana, Bert Sockpick, Henry James, and their teacher, Angela Alston, have seen these effects firsthand. Rising sea levels have corroded the land, and many people within their village have had to leave their homes and relocate.
My house is less than 100 feet away from the ocean, and it's rough living by the ocean, knowing that our house could fall in any day.
I remember staying at my grandfather's house, and it had to be moved because all the land that was in front of it got washed away. There was even another house in front of his, and they had to move that as well. And just seeing when I can see it now, I can still picture where my grandpa's house was. And to think that all that land is gone is really amazing. And the older people tell me that they used to even go way out there and play games like baseball and stuff over there. And to see it now that it's just water, it's weird.
Teresa says the people of Shishimarath have tried several different methods to protect their village from incoming tides. Sadly, these attempts have not been a success.
I also remember climbing onto the old seawall, the first seawall that they, or the second seawall that they put up. It was just sandbags covered with like wired fence or something. Whose idea was that? They expected that to last a long time, and it didn't. And we always played on them, and then we just ended up, like, every year we would see more and more of the sandbags go under the water till eventually there was nothing. There's still, like, a little brick of them that you can see, which is kind of sad. It reminds us that that was supposed to keep us safe, and it's not there anymore.
Teresa explains her perceptions of how the elders in their community feel about the changes that are taking place.
I think seeing the climate change happen is really hard for everybody, but especially for the elders, because they can remember how good it used to be, and now they have to, they've been watching it for so many years, they've been watching how badly it's affected our environment and their way of life.
Teresa and Bert fear that one day they may be forced to leave their village, and in the process, lose their unique culture.
Making us move into a city wouldn't be right. Why make us become like everybody else and lose our way of life?
If we do ever get moved to like a city or some other place because of not being able to get moved due to insufficient funds, it would be harder for like people who make their livings off carvings because they didn't really do well in high school. Or don't really have too good jobs, it would be harder for them to get their hands on materials like for carving and all these stuff that would be hard to get in like big cities. Getting traditional foods like ushak and all those other ones would be harder to get because of the differences between rural and urban lifestyle.
But Bert describes the people of Shishmaref will always have their history to be proud of.
One day our kids or our kids' kids would be able to say something like, oh, my grandpa came from a small village in Shishmaref, and that would be like a good thing to like brag about because lots of people could say that they're parents are from like Anchorage or a bigger city, and then they would have different stories.
The world has taken notice of the climate change in Shishmaref, and many people are documenting it.
One of the most interesting things about Shishmaref and climate change is that we've kind of become the poster child for the issue of climate change. And so we see reporters and journalists and photographers from all over the world that have been here. We've had a few from Japan, France, Germany, the Netherlands, everywhere come and interview our kids and make movies of our town. And that's kind of been a positive thing because it's gotten our kids, our students, a lot more exposure to foreign people than they would have gotten otherwise.
In return, visitors have also given back to Shishmaref.
Most people who come to Shishmaref from other countries are really friendly and really cooperative, and they're generally willing to come into the school and give presentations to the classes and explain what life is like somewhere else. And we've even had a group from the Netherlands that donated a whole bunch of video equipment to our school, some video cameras, tripod, tapes, hard drives. And that was just nice that they benefited from us with their story and their movies that they made, and then they shared that so that we could benefit from them.
The students have also created a group to raise awareness about the current condition.
We started the Save Our Shishmaref group, which fundraises money for the relocation. And when the Germany people came, they wrote an article about us in their newspaper, and the school there started fundraising for us. They made Shishmaref shakes, and when they sold them, they sent the money to us. So that was nice of them.
Along with the foreign exposure they have received, several people within our country have taken an interest as well, including Senator Mark Begich, Representative Don Young, former Secretary of Education Margaret Spelling, and other U.S. leaders.
With the help of others, Teresa and Henry examine realistic goals for the future of Shishmaref in combating climate change and preserving their unique culture.
I hope that in the future that Shishmaref will still be there, but it seems like it won't, and I hope if it's not there, then it's somewhere where everybody is still together and not separated and not put into a different city, because I don't want people to just be forced to move and give up their lifestyle and their culture, especially for the elders.
They should help Shishmaref by either making a better seawall or finding a place that Shishmaref will be good to live in for a long time.
Is it wicked not to care when they say that you're mistaken, thinking hopes is not of dreams that aren't there?
That was Nithya Theroux and Nikki Navio of the Alaska Teen Media Institute. Coming up on Fresh Greens.
In the mind of the public, the government plans confusion, making us think that we don't have to worry, but the facts disagree. We need action in a hurry. Your cars and homes all emit harmful gas, creating a greenhouse effect like the world's encased in glass.
Teens set their passion for the environment to music. Plus,
foraging for dinner in a dumpster?
It's a time commitment. You can't just, like, go jump into one. You're going to have to jump into 50 dumpsters before you find a good one.
That's when we come back. You're listening to Fresh Greens from Terrascope Youth Radio, New Hampshire Public Radio, and PRX.org, the public radio exchange. I'm Hisham Hadros. Welcome back to Fresh Greens from Terrascope Youth Radio, New Hampshire Public Radio, and PRX.org, the public radio exchange. I'm Hisham Hadros.
And I'm Anand Bonet. You're listening to a youth-produced public radio special. This hour, we've heard from young people from all over the country about what they think it means to be green. We also heard from young people from outside the United States.
That's right, Manon. It's a big planet. So we were really excited to hear from Maradi Oyo in Berlin, Germany. Listeners, you can hear Roddy Yo-Yo's submission on our website at nhpr.org.
Meanwhile, Robert Rogers, a youth producer from Out Loud Radio in San Francisco, California, sent us this next story. For him, being green means getting his hands dirty in the garden.
As we walk through the aisles of our local grocery store, many of us are uneasy about the harm we could be doing to ourselves and our environment with our purchase. We squint at the nutrition labels, and more often than not, we are horrified. Everything has too much salt, too much sugar, and way, way too many ingredients. Only the produce aisle gives us comfort. Finally, we think, something I know is good for me. We are relieved, but not for long. Our produce is covered in pesticides. Will the day come when we ask ourselves, what's really worse for me, this poisonous celery? Or these delicious Doritos? For the past few months, I haven't faced this dilemma. My refrigerator is a well-stocked cornucopia of ripe, organic produce I picked myself. How do I know it's safe? My friends planted it, and I've been tending the soil for weeks at a half-acre plot of land in our community park. My friends Amy and Mark, who built this massive garden up from a row of tomatoes in their neighbor's backyard, call their project Veggielution, an organization devoted to providing organic produce for San Jose's homeless shelters and priceless gardening experience for our community's youth. Here's Amy, co-founder of Veggielution and gardener extraordinaire.
We want to grow food on all of this land out here, and we want to act as a hub for the community to come in We want everybody to get out here and have a place where they can mix together and interact with each other on the basis of like a common thing, which everybody needs to eat food, right? We want to provide a springboard for youth and for anybody to start something new.
I've been riding my bike to and from VeggieLution's half-acre garden every weekend, checking up on the broccoli seeds I planted several weeks ago, and gazing in wonder as they sprout more and more every Sunday. The sun beats down on my sweaty back as I pedal through 5 miles of urban sprawl to reach my agricultural bower. The brisk change from congested city streets to a calm, languid garden, complete with roaming chickens and peacocks, is a welcome transformation. And the refreshing sight of row upon row of sunflowers, carrots, broccoli, chard, red tomatoes, green tomatoes, yellow tomatoes, round tomatoes, oblong tomatoes, and every other tomato you can think of is a sight for sore eyes. Located less than 100 yards from a freeway overpass and 300 yards from the nearest taqueria, VeggieLution's base of operations at Immerprush Park has become a haven for politically aware, environmentally conscious young gardeners who distrust modern methods of mechanized agriculture and want to learn how to grow things themselves.
My name is Angela. Right now we are behind the greenhouse at Immerprush Park, just outside of our little farm area, and we're sitting at a picnic table, lots of birds and a shady tree right behind us. We do our best to treat the land well and use it to its fullest potential. Like right now we're planting cover crops to replace the nitrogen in the soil, so it'll still be good to plant in the spring. The permaculture method is called Three Sisters, and it's corn, beans, and squash. You use the corn to trellis the beans, so the beans go up the corn stalk. Likewise, the beans replace the nitrogen into the soil that the corn takes out.
Though my affiliation with VeggieLution will soon be at an end, this is by no means the end of the VeggieLution. Amy and Mark have already begun groundbreaking on a new patch of land, a whole acre this time, which will be ready for harvesting before the end of the summer. Soon enough, VeggieLution's lofty ambition to wrestle away from the city the 8 unused acres from the back of the garden to the edge of the freeway barricade may not seem so grandiose.
That was Robert Rogers from Out Loud Radio in San Francisco, California. And now, from dirt digging to dumpster diving, Rebecca Barker from the Alaska Teen Media Institute in Anchorage discovered an unusual and controversial way that one local youth finds dinner. She sent us this report.
20-year-old Connor Huntington climbs into the dumpster quickly, using niches and the cold metal sides for steps. Brown and imposing, this dumpster is roughly 12 feet tall and stands behind a local big box bookstore. Even in the shadow of an Alaskan winter evening, with a stout building blocking most other light than traffic, footholds are still easy to find. Connor is an experienced dumpster diver.
There's a different way to get around every kind of dumpster's defense mechanism. The only thing you can't get around is a garbage compactor, because even if you get into a garbage compactor, you're just going to die, and that sucks.
Dumpster diving is the art of retrieving trash, and it can have any number of purposes. Those with keen eyes might just lean into a dumpster to pick up something interesting. Sometimes people short of money get essentials like food and clothing from dumpsters. But it can also be about more than just finding things. Connor says he practices some aspects of freeganism. Freeganism, a phrase co-opted from veganism, is a lifestyle that aims to decrease personal impact on the earth. Freegans aim to buy less, make more, and dive for the rest. And from a freegan perspective, Connor says dumpster diving is not only a way to get things for free, but also a critique of consumer society.
Everything that's actually political about dumpster diving just basically comes back to scarcity, and just the idea that instead of using what you have to help somebody, you're going to throw it away so you can charge more for it.
Don Winchester is the general manager at Vend Alaska, a locally owned vending machine distribution agency in Anchorage. Winchester disagrees with Connor's perceptions of business, but he says he is sympathetic.
I grew up on a farm and a farmer, so we grew what we ate, we produced, we traded. We never really had much money, but you know, there is nothing for free. I'm from the hippie era in the 60s, and it's wonderful. They want to try it, but I don't want them in my dumpster. But hey, bless them if they think they can do it. And that's what youth and stuff is all about.
In Connor's experience, most people don't enjoy finding him in their dumpsters.
People get really confused when they find you in their dumpsters. People rarely respond, like, actually violently, but people do get really pissed off sometimes. They're just threatened. Basically, it's like, that's the trash, you know?
Winchester says this last year, Vandalaska put up a fence to stop people from coming onto their property at night.
I just don't want anybody in my dumpster. It can't be healthy, for one thing. You know, we don't clean our dumpsters. we don't want people eating the outdated food. Somebody maybe could get sick. I just don't want people in the dumpsters, nor do we want people on our premises after our hours.
Winchester says Vandalaska used to donate their food to charities, but liability issues keep them from doing it now.
It is unfortunate. It's too bad, because even though there's an expiration date on, let's use potato chips and that, you know, they're good for another 2 or 3 months usually. So, but we can't do that nor risk it. So now we just have to put them in the dumpster.
Before he became a vegan, Connor ate out of dumpsters semi-regularly. He says it's not easy, especially since so many businesses use trash compactors, but it can be done.
In downtown Anchorage, down 1st, 2nd, 3rd Street, is where there's some very interesting dumpsters, but it's a time commitment. You can't just, like, go jump into one. You're going to have to jump into 50 dumpsters before you find a good one. Once you found a good one, you can go back, but, you know, you've got to be pretty much, like, obsessed. And, like, the great thing about being a vagrant is if you're a vagrant, you have a lot of free time. You wander from dumpster to dumpster. You look around.
There is a level of danger attached to eating food from a dumpster, says Chris Toffberg, supervisor for the Anchorage Municipal Health and Human Services Food Safety and Sanitation Program.
From a public health standpoint, that's not necessarily a good idea, because there's no temperature control. You got all sorts of vermin and all sorts of opportunities for cross-contamination in a dumpster. So we would advise against it. Actually, Anchorage is a great town for somebody to get a free meal, because there's a lot of resources. Downtown, just offhand, there's the Downtown Soup Kitchen. There's Beans Cafe. But that's the way I would advise it, because those are places that we inspect versus the questionable source that dumpster is.
Dumpster divers not only risk getting sick, they risk getting caught. But Officer Scott Chafin of the University of Alaska Anchorage Police says it isn't the diving itself that gets people in trouble.
Basically, there's not really anything illegal in Alaska about dumpster diving. However, it may depend on where the dumpster is located. If it's on the property and not given up, like it's not on the curb, like a garbage can, then they might be facing criminal trespass charges. But if it's out on the curb, it's fair game for anybody.
Trespassing on business property is a B misdemeanor, says Officer Chafin. The maximum penalty, he says, is 90 days in prison and a $500 fine.
Yeah, nothing too exciting tonight on the dumpstering.
Lit by a single streetlight, the outside of this dumpster shines, while the inside is as deep and dark as a cave.
But you'll run into people, a lot of them are like old-timers with pickup trucks, they're collecting scrap wood. That's pretty much the best thing dumpster diving is for. If you want to make stuff, you can find great dumpsters where you can get all the wood you need to make stuff. You can find metal scrap. You know, like whatever's going out of style, you get a lot of that. It is junk, that's why people throw it away, but they buy other junk and put it in their house.
Dumpster divers are alchemists, turning trash into treasure. It takes tenacity, but it's worth it to some. They'll risk trespassing charges, physical danger, and general disapproval of their hobby. To them, dumpster diving is a victimless crime with a productive purpose.
That was Rebecca Barker from the Alaska Teen Media Institute in Anchorage. Hisham, I don't know if I'd eat from a dumpster, but I'd definitely reuse wood or furniture from one. Rebecca's story reminded me that we act as if we live in a world of unlimited resources, but we don't.
But honestly, I'd rather go buy stuff from the store than go on a treasure hunt in a dumpster. That said, I would consider salvaging a can of soda, because I love soda. So does Libby Donovan from Blunt Youth Radio in Portland, Maine, who sent us this essay, about a key ingredient in her favorite afternoon pick-me-up.
3 o'clock and time for my daily caffeine kick. My choice? I'm not really big on coffee, so I always crack open a can of soda. I know it isn't the healthiest choice, but I really like soda, so whatever. But I was reading over the ingredients one time, because I'm weird like that, and I didn't really see sugar listed as an ingredient, which is odd, because my parents always told me that soda is full of sugar, whatever. And yeah, my favorite Dr. Pepper has like 40 grams of sugar per can, but it's not really sugar. It's high fructose corn syrup, which by some accounts is even worse than regular sugar. High fructose corn syrup is kind of gross. It's corn that goes through a chemical process to become a super sweet syrup used like sugar in a lot of highly processed foods like soda, candy, ketchup, cereal, crackers, bread, pretty much everything I eat. But high fructose corn syrup is different from sugar. It's a liquid that's piped into trucks. Yummy. It gives food and beverages that it's in an extra long shelf life. Exhibit A, Twinkies. And high fructose corn syrup is cheaper than other sweeteners due to federal subsidies of corn and high tariffs on imported sugar. And that is the root of the problem. Corn. Corn is a great crop in that it grows like crazy, but it's also hugely bad for the environment. Corn is a crop that isn't rotated, and it's a nitrogen hog, so it very quickly depletes the nutrients in the soil. And on top of all the pesticides that are sprayed on the corn, it also needs a huge amount of fertilizer, which runs off into the ocean and can cause dead zones, which are entire areas of the ocean, usually near mouths of rivers, that are starved of oxygen. So, what's the most eco-friendly sweetener? Unfortunately, it's not the widely used white stuff either. It's actually organic honey, preferably local, or real maple syrup, not the kind that's all high fructose corn syrup, the kind that I like. Or perhaps brown rice syrup, whatever that is. Or I guess you could always just do what your parents wanted you to do in the first place. Avoid sugar altogether. Your waistline and your planet will thank you for it.
That was Libby Donovan from Blunt Youth Radio in Portland, Maine. So, Hashem, do you still want that soda?
I certainly do. As much as I care about the environment, I love my soda. I have to have it, and I'll never let it go. Sorry. But now that I know what I know about corn syrup, my next soda might taste bittersweet.
Well, it's something for all of us to think about, not only for the Earth's sake, but for our health's sake as well.
That's almost all the time we have left this hour. Fresh Greens is a production of Terrascope Youth Radio at MIT, New Hampshire Public Radio, and the Public Radio Exchange, and is supported by a grant from the National Science Foundation.
Special thanks to Abby Goldstein and her production team at New Hampshire Public Radio, and to Jones Franzel from Generation PRX, a project that connects, supports, and distributes youth-made radio. Learn more at generation.prx.org.
Thanks to Ari Epstein and the staff of Terrascope Youth Radio, and to our fellow teen interns, who did a lot of work to help put this program together.
Finally, thanks to Kelly Horan, who wrote, edited, and produced this show, and always brought chocolate. You can learn more about this program, our partners, and our contributors at nhpr.org.
We'll leave you with an original global warming rap, produced and performed by Aaron King, Fahim Sina, and Nelson Dow of Terrascope Youth Radio. I'm Hisham Hadros.
And I'm Manon Monet. Thanks for listening. This has been Fresh Greens.
Let's go. It all started years ago with the Industrial Revolution in the factories.
all spewing out pollution. We move on, and we still contributing. In the mind of the public, the government plans confusion, making us think that we don't have to worry. But the facts disagree, we need action in a hurry. Your cars and homes all emit harmful gas, creating a greenhouse effect like the world's encased in glass.
I walk most of the time.
I put out more recycling than I do trash.
I only drive my car once or twice a week.
We recycle.
Yes. I just take public transportation. I take the T all the time. I try not to drive as much as I can.
Yeah, well, I can't afford a car, so I'm always on my feet.
It might not affect you, but what about your children? You might as well shoot them now, because that's who you're killing. Our country demands energy, so we keep on drilling. Our minds so greedy, only focused on making billions. They say our booming economy can't thrive with energy restrictions. Economy, these global warming problems seem like science fiction. We drive our SUVs like they're an addiction, but potentially this could be the end of humanity under many current predictions.
We're all gonna die because of it. That's pretty true.
You know how we had ice ages before? I think it's just that the Earth is warming up by itself. But I think humans are also causing it to go more rapidly.
I think it starts individually, and I think it goes all the way up to the government. I think everybody needs to be doing more than they're doing. Absolutely.
Pretty much, I think that we're on the path of just seeing the world demise.